This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app. No matter where you are, you can always take Em and Warren with you.
20 minutes past four.
There was an article published in the Conversation recently by Lyndon Ashcroft, who's a lecturer in climate science and science communication at the University of Melbourne. And what stood out to me was something that was published in a New Zealand newspaper about 110 years ago, and it was titled Coal Consumption Affecting Climate. And I read this. It said, the furnaces of the world are now burning about 2 billion tonnes of coal a year. When this is burned, uniting with oxygen, it adds about 7 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere yearly. This tends to make the air more effective blanket for the earth and to raise its temperature. And the effect may be considerable in a few centuries. Now, that was in the news 110 years ago. So why has it taken us so long to take notice? And are we finally ready to listen? Well, Lyndon Ashcroft, welcome to Joy Drive.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Lyndon, let's start with this newspaper piece. How did that come about?
This article, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not even 70 words long. It's 110 years old, and yet it's such a cut-through little snippet of science about how the atmosphere works. And this little article, and it was actually published a few months earlier in a magazine, in a mining magazine in Australia, of all places. It came about from research that was being done in the Northern Hemisphere that was doing some calculations about what happens if we change the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The person who kicked this sort of analysis off was Svante Arrhenius, who is a Swedish mathematician, and he was actually more interested in cooling the planet, what would happen, how the planet could cool. But he did these calculations and he thought, wow, if we double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we could increase the temperature of the planet. His calculations weren't as accurate as the ones we do today, but they weren't far off. And by 1900, he'd done these calculations and he realized we were burning coal, and he was starting to tell his classes at his university, temperatures are going to change and it's going to be us, which at the time was quite a fringe idea. It was quite a strange out there theory.
Lyndon, did anyone take notice 100 years ago when people were making this hypothesis?
Well, there was some attention paid to them and there were a few things that were written about it at the time. But this guy, Arrhenius, he had lots of different ideas and he published this theory with a lot of other theories. One of the things that he really cared about was that life on Earth started because there were seeds that were transported to planet Earth from interstellar space. And he had lots of different ideas. So the fact that this theory was put forward with a lot of his other ideas, and there was lots of other calculations that were being done by people around the world, and people, researchers at the time thought that volcanoes actually were the biggest thing we needed to worry about when it came to changing the temperature of the planet. And they kind of thought carbon dioxide might increase in the atmosphere, but the ocean would suck it up, so don't really worry. So there was some people listened to it, but then it was kind of dismissed as a bit of an aside, a bit of a strange theory that didn't get a lot of momentum.
So is that the main reason why it didn't, at the time, it wasn't taken up as a, you know, with seriousness, and it did take, you know, a bit of time after that? Because we had world wars, didn't we? And what happened during those periods?
Yeah, that's right. So I think it was a combination. You know, there was a lot of different things flying around. The idea that human behavior could change the whole planet, I think, was something, as we know, takes a long time for people to grasp. And then just as maybe scientific momentum was gathering, of course, the First World War happened, and that really took the wind out of the sails of this argument. People got really focused on other things. The same thing kind of happened in World War II. There was starting to be some development, but then the focus shifted to how do we make more efficient weaponry and warfare and those kinds of things. So I think it was a combination of taking time for theories to become concrete and also just global focuses on other areas. I don't know how much maliciousness there was in keeping this information secret in that earlier part.
We're chatting with Lyndon Ashcroft, lecturer in climate science and science communications at the University of Melbourne, about climate change having been in the news for 110 years. And if we're ready to finally listen, some key figures, you know, in history, Margaret Thatcher, for example, saw climate change as a threat. Why wasn't this enough to generate some action?
That's right. After the Second World War, there was sort of more and more momentum gathering. The science was pretty clear by that point. And I should also say that the understanding about the greenhouse effect, you know, that more water vapor or more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will trap more heat, that science had been around for a really long time. Since like the 1850s, it had been known about for ages. But connecting that to human behaviour took a lot longer. And then by the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher, who you'd hardly say is like a raging greenie, she was saying, this is a big risk, this is going to be a big problem and we need to do something about it. And, you know, I'm not an expert in history of science, but I think around that time where there was going to be global calls for action at a political level. We also had some really powerful testimonials made to the Senate in the US that was said, look, climate change is already happening. Temperatures are already increasing. That was kind of said by scientist James Hansen in the 80s in the US. But around that time is where we also started to get a rise, I think, in misinformation. So there were large lobby groups, there were large organizations and think tanks, I suppose, that were vested in not having too much government control over what people did. And also, you know, there were a lot of oil and mine and gas companies that were making a lot of money. And while they might have understood what was happening, it was not in the interest of their shareholders for that information to be shared. So I think this is the stage where we started to get the rise of kind of misinformation and a deliberate muddying of the waters in the conversation around the science of a heating planet.
Lyndon, something, I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but if we look at something simple that, you know, has come out of, I guess, research, you know, taking a paracetamol for a headache, for example, you know, we know that that works as a pain reliever and we accept it. We go down, we buy it, we take it if we've got a headache or if our doctor advises, what have you. You know, we don't necessarily challenge it because it's accepted science, okay? It's been proven to work and it's gone through its studies. Where did the skepticism around climate science really, really kick off? Because one of the things that concerned me is our media seemed to say, okay, you know, the science is in, this is what is happening to the earth, but we still need to give voice to the skeptics, even though the science was settled. Yet we don't necessarily do it for other scientific things like my Panadol analogy.
I'm nodding my head vigorously with you there because I think this issue, because it is so large and it affects so many of our decisions and it does involve making large global decisions. Mm. You can go down and buy a Panadol and it doesn't affect me, but if the whole world and all the countries in the world need to make a decision about how we behave, that does involve you know, people working together. And I think there's some organisations and some belief systems. I don't mean religion. I mean sort of people's values just reject that and so reject the idea of the science as well. You'd also argue that that's what media thinks makes a good story. It's a bit of drama. It's a bit of tension. And so we see it. We don't see it so much anymore. I think the science of climate change is pretty settled across most mainstream media organisations. But, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was that, oh, we have to make it a balanced view discussion. We have to have one person saying one thing and one person saying another thing, which really slowed down action because it introduced an aspect of doubt and it introduced an aspect of, well, both of these voices are equally valid, whereas one's representing 99% of science and one's representing, you know, retired engineers.
Exactly. And I suppose then, of course, you know, by giving these skeptics, I suppose, you know, the platform of appearing to be the balance, it also gave ammunition for, you know, the vested interests like the fossil fuel industries as well to start to use that as evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And some of those voices were supported by those vested interests.
Lyndon, after, you know, these decades of almost stalling, do you think that we're now at a point where change will happen and we can, you know, and will decarbonize the world?
Oh, I'm so hopeful, Em. I really am hopeful about that. I think we've got a lot of things aligning now. We have a lot of momentum in governments around the world. We have a lot of ground swelling as well. There's a lot of community momentum you could argue, and some people do argue, that the Australian government's current policies aren't quite enough to get us to a level where we avoid the worst impacts of warming. But they're better than nothing, and they're also matched by local government pledges and by state pledges. And also, I think community groups as well are working harder and harder. So we're seeing action at every single level, which to me is really hopeful. We've already warmed the planet by over a degree, nearly 1.5 degrees in Australia. It's 1.4 degrees warmer now than it was 100 years ago. And with that comes more heat extremes and more intense downpours and all sorts of things that can really impact our health and our livelihood. And so the time to act, if it wasn't going to be 110 years ago, the time to act is right now, and I'm hopeful that that is happening.
Lyndon, I think it's been a really interesting chat. I think it's good to sort of understand, you know, why we haven't done anything, so that if, you know, or when the next challenge does come up for us as you know, a species, we don't repeat the same behaviours. So thank you so much for chatting with us on Joy Drive.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lyndon Ashcroft, lecturer in climate science and science communication at the University of Melbourne.
Joy Drive. We ask the questions so you don't have to. Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app. No matter where you are, you can always take Em and Warren with you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.